Kevin Kleiman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. What do you do when there's too much milk? You can't just turn off the cow. Today, our current milk surplus and what's being done about it. A Korean taco truck? It's true. I'll tell you what every foodie in LA is talking about. How the current deep recession is affecting LA's restaurants, plus the etiquette of eating food on mass transit. Jonathan Gold is here too, but first, let's see what's in season at the farmers markets this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We love to be at the market and try to think of creative, interesting things to do with all the fantastic ingredients we find here. And, of course, our chefs who come to the market every week are so inspirational. And once again, we've managed to get a hold of Mark Peel, who's here, as always, shopping at the market. And let's try to get some late January post-inauguration inspiration going here at the market today, Mark.
You're right. Late January, no peaches, no apricots, but that doesn't mean that there aren't great things at the market. You have to really adapt yourself to the season. And what I love right now are, hold on to your seats, cabbage.
Oh, cabbage, still my heart.
Cabbage is delicious. It has a little bit of spice to it. It's really high in calcium. It's high in vitamin C. Anyhow, make a cabbage soup. My favorite is a savoy cabbage. That's the round head with crinkly leaves, a little bit spicy. Slice it nice and thin. Saute in a little bit of olive oil with some bacon, if you like, optional. But I love the bacon. Everything's better with bacon. Then add, I would say, about half a head. And then add maybe one can of chicken broth,
is that a large 16?
Can.
What is that? Yeah, the big can.
I don't know, okay. Big can. Right. And then enough water to make half a gallon.
2 quarts.
Simmer for a while. Very thinly sliced carrots. A little bit of celery heart. Just the heart. It's really tender, really delicious.
Not celery root, celery heart.
Celery heart.
Okay.
The inside with the leaves okay. For the flavor, rice intense flavor. Just simmer it for about half an hour very gently, and you're done. Salt and pepper.
But you puree it then, right?
Or No. Oh. Leave it whole. It's brothy. It ends up looking a little bit like a minestrone.
Oh.
Kind of like a German minestrone, if you will.
Mm-hmm. So there's no garlic, no onions, no leeks? No,
I don't think so.
Okay.
Oh, you could put a little bit of onion in it, but garlic I don't think really goes with the cabbage as well.
Okay. And a savoy cabbage, now those are in season now. When you say half a cabbage, are you just kind of like cutting it in half, cutting out that huge big stem, and then cutting it real thin?
Yes. Okay. Cut it vertically right through the stem, cut out the core, slice thin.
Now, from this basic, this sounds like a really great basic kind of a recipe that we could maybe adapt for other sorts of nice, wonderful winter veggies, do you think?
Oh, yeah. You know, you could make with the same kind of proportions of just the base, I mean, the water, the chicken broth,
A little bit of butter, oil.
I would saute some bacon. Then, if you want to make a little potato and leek soup, very thinly slice the leeks, chunk up the potatoes, saute gently, all of that very gently. Again, the celery, a little bit of carrot, not too much carrot. It'll be too sweet with the carrot.
Oh.
And then you would puree that. You simmer that for about half an hour to an hour, and then you would puree that for a nice leek and potato soup. Salt and pepper, done.
Now, do you peel the potatoes?
Oh, absolutely. Thank you for reminding me. Oh. Russet potatoes.
Oh, really? Not the Yukon Golds?
No. You want a starchy potato, as they call a mealy potato. That gives it best texture.
Well, as always, it's been an inspiration. And I'm imagining some, like, grilled cheese sandwiches with all this, too. That'd be good. That was Mark Peel. He's the chef owner of Campanile. He's here always getting inspired. Now let's go over and see what Evan is finding to cook at the Hollywood Farmers Market.
Hi, this is Evan. I found myself here at the Hollywood Farmers Market, and I'm here with Lily Baltazar from ABC Rhubarb. You're the famed herb lady of the markets. Your table is really filled today. It's like a really big assortment. So give us an idea of what you have on the table this week.
Today I'm featuring watercress. Extra good. Has a very, very nice, crisp, bitter in a sense that it's bitter, spicy. Really can elevate just a regular salad. You can add the bitter greens, which would be watercress, arugula, dandelion greens, to spruce up any salad.
So you have watercress, you have rue, I saw. Tell me what you use rue for.
It's Shakespeare's herb, as you know, and it's a bitter sweet herb, and I always say non-culinary because it's very, very bitter. If you have a pantry pest problem, if you have a little flying gnat problem, set that roux right on top, wards off all flying objects.
I love that.
And it really works.
You have everything out there. You've got sage, you have thyme.
I call them my pantry herbs, the herbs that are a must for every kitchen. Thyme, sage, oregano, chives, dill will liven up and make incredible food additives to anything that you want to make.
What I love to do is just cut it up raw and throw it into salad and make an herbal lettuce salad. Use some sort of very mild leaf, like a bib lettuce, and just add handfuls of delicious herbs and then some feta cheese. Yum. And I notice also that you have the most beautiful oyster mushrooms.
With the oyster mushrooms, bake in parchment paper at 350, 25 minutes. All you need is olive oil and some chopped herbs, and they're voila, they're done. Add them to a rice pilaf, a brown rice.
Yeah, I'm hungry. That was Lily Baltazar. She is ABC Rhubarb. We're here at the Hollywood Farmers Market.
Go to kcrw.com/goodfood for pictures of what's fresh this week at the area farmers markets. Next, for those who don't know about this yet, a Korean taco truck that inspires an hour-long wait. Where is it? You have to follow them on Twitter to find out. More on that when Good Food returns on KCRW and KCRW.com. Love tacos? Love Korean food? Well, it's now possible to have both together in one dish. And to me, it totally makes sense. Eddie Lin of DeepEndDining.com is here to talk about Kogi, a new taco truck currently roaming the streets of Los Angeles, serving a combination of Korean and Mexican food. Hi, Eddie.
Hey, let's see. Buenos dias and annyeonghaseyo. So that's Korean and Spanish.
My response to this is I'm just amazed somebody hasn't done it sooner. Because taking that delicious Korean meat and putting it in a good corn tortilla.
Yeah, a nice portable delivery system.
Oh, my God. Right? That just sounds like so fabulous.
Well, and that's why it's doing so well at nightclubs and at bars, you know, after midnight and, you know, at UCLA when they're parked in front of UCLA. And actually at on certain Sundays at certain Korean churches. You know, you just walk out of church and there it is, you know. You don't need to go to a restaurant. You don't need to have a bowl or even chopsticks. You know, you get your Korean meat and the condiments and you can pick from chicken, pork, beef, short ribs. And there it is in a nice corn tortilla.
So let's describe it in depth. It's all the regular Korean meats that you would get in a barbecue situation.
Precisely.
Right?
Kalbi, which for those who don't know is a Korean short ribs, but without the bone part. And kalbi is basically Korean barbecue. It's marinated in a sweet and salty soy sauce-based marinade. And then it's spiced up a little with samjang, which is a Korean red pepper paste. And some cilantro and other condiments are thrown in, a little bit of onion.
When these meats are served on the tortilla, are they served with the condiments that would top a regular taco truck? Taco? Guacamole?
No guacamole. It leans towards the traditional Korean stuff. For example, the samjang. There's not going to be any salsa.
Is there going to be any kimchi?
They're thinking about it.
Because to me, the whole idea of taking meat, topping it with spicy things, and putting it in a tortilla, I mean, it's a no-brainer.
Exactly. You know, honestly, Koreatown is the perfect place for this kind of fusion to happen. Because actually, in Koreatown, there are more Mexican-Americans or Hispanics or Latinos than Koreans. And so when you consider it, I don't know, I see it kind of as a socio-gastronomic, if that's a term, situation that was bound to happen. it's just this natural fusion, you know, because of the area it evolved from.
Now, are we talking about something that spontaneously occurred with a small street vendor, or is this a thought-out, tricked-out truck?
The truck itself is actually thought out. I mean, they're, you know, you can tell from their really nice sign. You know, they've worked on the graphics, their cool flame logo, the menu.
Who are they?
Actually, there are a couple of guys, actually three people. There's a husband and wife team, and they are food professionals. They're food and beverage people for high-end hotels. One of the guys is named Mark Manguera, and he thought of it one drunken night out on the town, you know. And
usually those kind of thoughts don't come to fruition.
Right, exactly. But this one, thank goodness, stuck around. By the time he recovered from his hangover, he told his friend, Chef Roy Choi. And Roy has a pretty extensive background as a chef. He actually cooked at Le Bernardin, and also he executive chefed recently at Rock Sugar.
Now, who mostly eats these, and where does the truck show up?
That's another great thing about this truck. Their Kogi barbecue is very, you know, Web 2.0. You never know where they're going to be. And the only way to find out, really, is to go on their Twitter.com site. And Twitter, for those who don't know, is kind of this instant, it's kind of a mini blog where you do really quick messages. What you do is you just sign up, you know, with their Twitter page, and they'll let you know exactly where they're going to be at what time. You know, you can find out from their website also what new items are coming out, you know, what they're testing, and also give them feedback.
Do they go a lot to clubs? Is
they
it
go
like
a lot.
The clubber's friend? That,
oh, my God. You know, I wish, you know, Evan, when I was moonwalking at the Florentine Gardens back in the day, oh, I would have loved to see that Kogi barbecue truck out there waiting for me, you know, as I stumbled out. But yeah, mainly nightclubs, bars, generally after midnight. And they're doing the farmers markets. There's only one truck currently, so they're definitely going to have to get a few, a fleet perhaps.
Did you look into the kitchen? What's it like?
It's a standard catering truck. I mean, a roach coach or taco truck or whatever you want to call it, you know. It's just it's basic. There are lines 500 people deep.
You're kidding.
1 hour wait. It's insane. It is.
Oh my God.
They waited in the rain, you know. I can't believe it.
Oh, I know? Can. I can. I mean, yum.
Yeah, it's yum. And when you're drunk, it's yummier. It's, I don't know. I don't know why that is, but it just is.
I love the photos on your site of beautiful young girls in their spiky heels waiting in front of the truck.
Right. That doesn't hurt business either.
No, I'm sure not. Thank you so much, Eddie.
You're very welcome.
Pictures and the link to the Twitter feed for the Kogi Korean Taco Truck is online at kcrw.com/goodfood. There are lots of benefits to having a mobile restaurant like Kogi. With a brick-and-mortar restaurant, there's a lot of overhead, let me tell you. And when a recession rolls through, the first places that feel the pinch are often restaurants. So how are Los Angeles restaurants doing? I'll be back to find out. That's coming up next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. All restaurants, no matter how hot, new, or let's say old faves, all of us ride along the greater economic wave. When the economy's good, we're chugging along, doing okay. When it's bad, it's scary. Leslie Bala, former editor of Eater LA, now new editor of Tasting Table LA, is with us to talk about recession times in the business. It's not good out there, is it?
No, it's not. It's not pretty. It's sad for all of my friends in the business. I know everybody's pulling really hard to try and make ends meet, make things work. There are a lot of restaurants who are still doing pretty good. I think numbers are down everywhere. Sales are down more than, I think, actual volume of customers.
Yeah, I think what a lot of us are seeing are almost the same number of feet, but mouths that are choosing differently.
And that has repercussions everywhere. I mean, that when the restaurant's sales are down, then it's harder to pay the staff. You know, a lot of people, I don't think, give restaurant staff in Los Angeles enough credit because it seems to be such a transient business here, and a lot of actors and actresses, that's, you know, the cliche, they're just an actress.
But that's not really the way it is.
But that's not. They're willing to do what they need to do right now to get through it. Everybody knows that we'll get through it. And I think some of the changes, you know, from a consumer level that I've seen, you know, I see some menu changes. I see a lot of specials. I see less expensive cuts of meat on the menu so people can lower their price points because they want to get people in the door, because it's better to have someone in than no one.
So from the consumer's perspective, is it a good time to eat out now? Are there a lot of special wine nights and special dinners?
There are two reasons why it's a great time to eat out right now. The specials are one thing. Again, they're doing whatever it takes to have people come in. So somebody like Campanile, they just put their soup kitchen night on Wednesday. They started this last year during the writer's strike, and it's $22 per person for three courses. And this is Campanile, you know what I mean? It's like, let's get them in the door, let's give them a good meal. It's better to have somebody in paying $22 per person than nobody in paying $50 or whatever. Edison also isn't necessarily a restaurant, it's a lounge, but they have this 35-cent martini night on Fridays.
Are you kidding me?
No, but you get free soup and grilled cheese, tomato soup and grilled cheese along with it.
So, wait, you're going into this brand new mega hipster club, which is just fabulous looking, I have to say, and you can have a 35-cent, not dollar?
Just one.
But you can get a 30 more than one.
Right. 35-cent martini, tomato soup and grilled cheese.
And then what happens? Do they lock you in so you have to order more?
I don't know. You know, it is such an amazing deal. And I think it really has picked up for them. And people really locked into this. Why wouldn't they? I mean, the grilled cheese and soup is free. The most extreme I found is Eric Greenspan at the Foundry on Melrose just announced last week that he is guaranteeing that you will love his food so much that if you don't, and for any reason you don't love the food, you don't love your meal, he will give you a gift certificate to come back for another try.
When a program like Dine LA comes along, which is about to start, it's perfect timing.
Exactly. I was going to reference Open Table, which did this out of the blue. They did an appetite stimulus plan. The same thing as Restaurant Week. The same thing as Dine LA. Three courses, $35 to $45, lunch or dinner, all these great options. And yes, instead of going out to one restaurant and spending $100 to $150 per person, you can try three restaurants in 1 week. What I love about Restaurant Week is you can try restaurants that you normally wouldn't because it may be too expensive, or you can try places that you really didn't think you'd want to spend the money on. That's my opinion. So some place that maybe you had a lower opinion of, but go ahead and try it for lunch. You might be pleasantly surprised.
For us, I'm really excited actually about it because it's a fun thing for people to get reintroduced to your food if you've been around for a really long time. Also, this year, Dine LA has that third tier. Last year, a lot of the really high-end places didn't feel they could participate because the price structure didn't allow them to. But this year, they've added a third tier, which is still really a dinner, I think, is $44.
Yeah. I mean, it's a total bargain. And you can afford to get a glass of wine to go along with it or two or a bottle.
We should say that Dine LA is brought to us by LA Inc., which is the Los Angeles Tourism and Convention Board. And I just think for years, the restaurant community has been sort of out there on its own. And it's really, really nice to have some arm of the government coming in and saying, let's organize a party. And that's sort of what it is.
And to really support the industry.
Because absolutely.
It is very important. It definitely needs that kind of push. And it's so successful in other cities like New York and San Francisco. I know a lot of people were really happy with it last year in the industry.
And let's talk for a minute about the ripple effect. if you don't go to restaurants, then the vendors don't sell their food.
Right. And even it could go, I mean, it can go as far as linen companies. I mean, it just, it is such a ripple effect. It really, when the economy's bad, it's bad for everybody.
Everybody. Yeah. And it takes very little to bring it back to a place where it's still challenging, but it's not quite so scary.
Right.
Thank you, Leslie.
Thanks so much, Evan.
Leslie Bala is the former editor of Eater LA, a popular restaurant blog, and soon-to-be editor of Tasting Table LA, a new daily email newsletter that's launching in February. I'll give you a link to the newsletter. Find it at kcrw.com/goodfood. Food is a comfort, both to the distressed and to the happy. In fact, when you look at this country, we sure are emotional people. In preparation for Valentine's Day, we at Good Food are collecting stories of what you eat or what you don't eat when coping with heartbreak. Call us and leave a message at 310-581-5858. We'll compile your thoughts and air them on our Valentine's Day show. So remember, what do you need to eat when you're dealing with heartbreak? Call us at 310-581-5858. Chinese New Year begins on Monday. It will be the Year of the Ox. The holiday brings traditional Chinese foods. I'll be right back on Good Food with a tour of this ancient holiday. That's coming up on KCRW and KCRW.com. Every year as Chinese New Year approaches, I take my kitchen god and make sure he's clean and in a good place. Yesterday, I put a bouquet of chamomile flowers in front of him. So what's a nice Jewish girl doing leaving offerings to a Chinese god? Well, as Grace Young taught me years ago, you can't be too careful. Grace is the author of some of our favorite cookbooks, including Breath of a Wok. So Grace, let's talk about the kitchen god for those who don't know him.
The kitchen god is an old-fashioned household deity in Chinese culture. Many people no longer celebrate the kitchen god. My parents don't, but my grandmother did. And it's a tradition that I've been following for the last 10 years or so. The Chinese believe that the heart of the home is in the kitchen, and the kitchen god altar is next to the stove so that the kitchen god can oversee all the family's activities. And so just before Chinese New Year's, it's very important to make offerings to the kitchen god so that he'll make a favorable report about each family when he goes up to the Jade Emperor to make his report. And in Chinese culture, it is totally legitimate and expected that you make kitchen food bribes. In this economy that we're having right now, we're hearing about so much corruption, but it's legitimate to give food to sweeten the kitchen god's words when he gets up to the Jade Emperor, and also to give him rice wine or martinis or whatever is your preference, so that he'll be so drunk that he'll forget your bad deeds, or he'll slur his words so that the Jade Emperor can't understand him.
Now, a lot of people, when they come into my kitchen, they've heard I have a kitchen god, and they expect to see a figurine.
Yes, and that's what I expected when I first went to Chinatown looking for a kitchen god. I was looking for a statue. In fact, there are statues. I collect kitchen gods now, and so in Hong Kong and China, I was able to find two different statues. But it's more common to find a picture. But the most common of all is just four Chinese characters on a wooden plaque that's normally painted red, and the characters are painted in gold or written in gold. And the four Chinese characters in Cantonese are Ding Fuk Zhou Guan, which means reserve fortune kitchen god. So I think all of us need to definitely make reservations for prosperity and good fortune.
Yeah,
so
he's
it's
like
very
our,
important.
He's like our ace in the hole.
I hope so.
So along with with taking care of him and giving him offerings. At the time of the Chinese New Year's, there's also a whole series of food that families enjoy for various reasons and foods they avoid.
Yes, the most important meal of the entire year is New Year's Eve. Most families eat 8 or 9 courses. This is very, very old-fashioned. Everybody goes home. Lots of friends of mine have often said, I was in Chinatown, it was really quiet and dead. But the tradition is to have the meal at home, just as people eat Christmas dinner at home and normally don't go out to a restaurant. So we ate 8 courses because in Cantonese, the number 8, bot, sounds like fat, and fat means prosperity. So that's a very good omen. Some people eat 9 courses because the number for 9, gul, sounds like the word for infinity. So that has a good meaning to it. No one ever eats 4 dishes because the number 4, say, sounds like death. And the number 7, cut, is actually the Chinese number for death also. You know, in funeral rites, they always do things in 7s. So that's not very lucky at all. Then there are the specific foods that we eat. Everything has meaning. You eat a whole chicken. Doesn't matter how it's prepared. Soy sauce chicken, salt roast chicken, the famous Chinese Hainan chicken that's served with scallion and ginger sauce. The meaning of a chicken is that you have a proper beginning and end to your year. Some people eat scallops, clams, or oysters because their shells resemble ancient Chinese coins. And also when they open, it represents a fresh new beginning. The lettuce is very, very important because sang choy in Cantonese, the word for lettuce, sounds like growing fortunes. So you could stir fry lettuce. Mushrooms are very important because they grow quickly.
For prosperity, right?
For prosperity. Everything is about prosperity, Evan.
And what foods would you absolutely never have on a New Year table?
My family would never have melon, as in water, as in winter melon, because the word melon, gua, sounds like death.
I understand tofu also is not a good word.
Yeah, doufu, because fu sounds like the word bitter. They say that when you have a kitchen god in your kitchen, that it prevents you from having kitchen disasters. And he makes your food more nutritious and more delicious. But most importantly, the idea is if you're well fed, then you'll have lots of energy and you'll be able to be very productive and therefore prosperous.
So if we wanted to set up our own altar, what would we do?
Well, I've posted the 4 classic characters on my website. You could just frame it in a picture frame and put it by your stove. And then I take a Chinese rice bowl and just put raw grains of rice into it. And then every time I give an offering to the kitchen god, I light 3 incense. And then I place the incense into this rice bowl and the rice holds it. I always put the fruit offering in front of the kitchen god, sometimes some rice wine. You take 3 bows. And if you want to be very Chinese, you would say ding fuk zhou guan, as to reserve your fortune, kitchen god.
Oh, lovely. Now, this will be the year of the ox. What does that mean?
Every animal has a different obvious characteristic, and so therefore the year is said to have those characteristics. So the ox is supposed to be very diligent, very dull and brooding, persistent, and he works hard despite challenges. So he seems to be the perfect animal for our challenging times.
Absolutely. Grace, as always, this has just been such a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Evan. And Gong Hei Fa Choy, wishing you great, good health, and good fortune.
Grace Young is the author of The Breath of a Wok, Unlocking the Spirit of Chinese Wok Cooking Through Recipes and Lore. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood for a picture of Grace's altar and a recipe for the new year. Gong Hei Fa Choy. Pho, spelled P-H-O, is a meaty broth with noodles. It's the signature dish of Vietnam. When Good Food returns, we'll go with Jonathan Gold to Pho Town, a stretch of El Monte that's all about this delicious noodle soup. That's in 1 minute right here on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. One of your favorite times of the week, and mine as well, is when we get to sit back and listen to Jonathan Gold of Pulitzer Prize-winning Los Angeles Weekly fame, author of many counterintelligence columns. Where are we going today?
South El Monte.
And what will we find there?
Well, you'll find many things in South El Monte, but today I'm going to some pho restaurants.
More than one?
Several. There's a stretch of Garvey between the Rio Hondo River and the South El Monte border that seems to be almost wall-to-wall Vietnamese noodle places. They all more or less specialize in the same thing, which is to say the Vietnamese beef noodle soup known as pho.
Now, what are the sort of standard components of pho, and then what are some variations?
So much pho in such a limited amount of time reminded me a little bit of the time that for Savour magazine, I ate Big Macs at 15 different restaurants. There's differences, but they're not that vast. That being said, sometimes they're pretty considerable.
Now, do all of these places make their own broths, or is there one huge broth place that's just pumping out 55-gallon drums?
They all make their own broth. I mean, the broth, I think, is probably the key to great pho. I suppose the things you'd have to take consideration is the broth, which should have a certain amount of bones, but not too much, be long simmered and not super simmered, should probably not have as much MSG as some of the restaurants would like it to have, and have like a really good, solid, beefy taste overlaid by cinnamon and star anise and sort of that sweet, bitter taste of burnt onion. The other things in the bowl of pho that you look for besides the broth are the meat. You know, is it good quality meat? Is it well cooked? If you're getting the dak biet, the house special, which is usually a combination of all the available meats, there should be tripe. There should be, it's called flank, but it's not really flank. It's like a cut of beef that's very well done. There's sort of a briskety thing. There's rare beef. I mean, beef that's essentially raw and it cooks in the heat of the broth. And there should be a big, considerable plate of herbs and vegetables to put in the broth, which must include the sawtooth herb, which looks kind of like a big dandelion leaf. It's not as bitter, but it has a really nice, solid presence. And the thing that's great about the sawtooth herb is that if it cooks for about 10, 20, 30 seconds, it has this really sort of lovely presence.
So you add it in yourself
table. You add it yourself. You tear up the herbs. There's usually basil. There'll be bean sprouts. I don't put in the bean sprouts. Some people like it. There'll be a sliced serrano chili. And, of course, the noodles themselves, which I don't think anybody actually makes. I mean, they all buy them, but some people like the soft, slithery, almost luxurious feeling, and some people like the sort of al dente pho noodle sensation.
How much variation is there?
A surprising amount, actually. The place that I think is probably the best one of the bunch is this place called Pho Minh. The broth has that almost like shimmering taste of something that's been simmered for a really long time. I think they use somewhat less MSG than the other people do. there's just this depth to it that makes the, you know, squeeze of lemon juice, the herbs seem almost superfluous. Pho, of course, you know, arose in Hanoi. It's a Hanoi-style noodle. The way we've gotten it here is almost always people from South Vietnam who came there after the big migration from north to south probably 80 years ago. But the northern style, which is sometimes, you'll sometimes see on the menu as pho bac, is slightly different. The broth is slightly less jazzy. There aren't a lot of different kinds of meat. And there's a little bit of ginger in there to sort of spark things up a little bit. And it's sort of like this pure, full flavored broth. Many of the places that do this, at least in El Monte, will do it with filet mignon or some variation of filet. And some of them will even have the meat sliced on the side so that you put it in the, you put the filet in the broth when you want it to cook, then you take it out. Pho Minh has a lot of cinnamon presence to it, which is nice. And the noodles are soft and there's a purity to it. Then you go around the corner to what I think is pronounced Pho Win, and the broth is a little bit gamier, as if like organ meats have been involved. And there's obviously MSG in there. It's also delicious in its way. It's like sort of turned up to 11. It, you know, it's brass and you know it's wrong, but it's like, you know, listening to a rock and roll song after you've been listening to Gershwin. It's like the Gershwin may be technically better, but you listen to rock and roll too.
So tell us once again where this large concentration of pho places is that you've been talking about.
This pho street is Garvey as it goes through South El Monte.
Maybe it should be renamed the Pho Street.
Pho, yeah.
Thank you so much, Jonathan.
You're welcome.
Get more Jonathan Gold at the LA Weekly, where he is their Pulitzer Prize-winning restaurant writer. Find links to his columns and to a slideshow of El Monte's Pho Town at kcrw.com/goodfood. It takes a lot to get a cow to produce milk. And in this country, we drink a lot of milk. But milk is a commodity, and right now, there is a glut of milk on the market. So what to do? You can't just unplug the cow. What happens to surplus milk when there's too much? I'll tell you when Good Food returns on KCRW and KCRW.com. Production of milk is something that this country has perfected. Today, one cow can produce the amount of milk that it once took 10 cows to produce. In fact, we've got over 9 million dairy cows in this country alone. And thanks to globalization, U.S. milk has been in high demand across the world. But just as the bubble has burst in housing and finance, milk is having a tough run. The global demand is soured due to a rising dollar and a recovery of other countries' dairy supplies. This glut of milk means the price is plummeting. What happens to the farmer and to the cows? I've asked Brian Gould, a professor and agricultural economist at the University of Wisconsin, to give us a picture of the industry. Give me an idea of the fluctuation in prices for the farmer.
Well, it's been quite dramatic, and it's been in the sense that it's occurred over the last couple of months. Starting in December of 2008, at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, a pound of cheddar cheese was going for $1.80. As of yesterday, I think it was $1.05. So that's about a 40% drop in the price of cheese. And in Wisconsin, which I'm calling you from, about 80 to 90% of our milk goes to cheese manufacturing. And when you get a 40% drop in one of the primary users of your product, it's a real problem. We're anticipating about a 30% drop from last month, our main milk price come February from the January level. So it's an incredible, and it's not a marginal change. This is a very significant change, and it's happening extremely quickly.
Now, I would imagine if you're a farmer and you're facing this drop, you can't just unplug the cows from the milking machines. You still have to feed them. What do they do? Do they sell herds for meat?
Well, there is a program that's a producer-funded or a farmer-funded program. It's called this Cooperatives Working Together to buy out herds to reduce the milk supply, because there is a recognition that we have too much milk in the U.S., and the U.S. dairy farmer has an incredible ability to produce milk. In Wisconsin, we're averaging about 20,000 pounds of milk per cow per year. So there is some efforts to try to reduce the herd. But again, as you indicated, the milk cow is like an investment. It has a productive cycle that goes over many years, and it takes many years to get it into the herd. So making a decision to get the cow out of the herd is a long-term decision. And in terms of reacting to the current prices, we need to see how long this is going to be. And I think farmers, they had a relatively good year last year. And we're hoping through our education efforts here and other universities that we tried to help producers get caught up on their bills to be able to weather these downturns. And there are some risk management vehicles out there that can help them control their volatility, but not a lot of farmers take advantage of that.
What's being done with the excess milk?
Well, there's a program out there. It's called under the new 2008 Farm Bill, there's a program called the Dairy Product Support Program. And under that program, the USDA, specifically the Commodity Credit Corporation, has an outstanding offer to the dairy industry to buy manufactured products at a fixed price. And these products are butter, non-fat dry milk, and cheddar cheese. And they're at a fixed price, and they're set to be fairly low, so they're not crowding out the domestic market. But that offer is always on the table, and manufacturers of these products can sell to the federal government as much as they want at that fixed price.
The milk surplus that the government buys, is that then given to food pantries, sold to countries through hunger programs?
There's a variety of mechanisms by which that inventory is reduced. One, it can be sold back to the market at 10%, no less than 10% over what the federal government paid for it. So, for example, non-fat dry milk is purchased at 80 cents. It would have to be sold back at 88 cents. Another alternative is, just like you said, it could be donated to a variety of domestic and international programs. I've known in the past, for example, I think it was in 06, that some non-fat dry milk was basically sold at discount out west to owners of dairy cattle because of a drought situation. They're using it as feed. Also, it is used for the school lunch program to a certain degree.
Do you see this as a long-term problem?
It's confounding because there's a futures markets for fluid milk. It's called Class 3 milk. That's the milk used for manufacturing cheese. Currently, February's futures market price for Class 3 milk is about $10 a hundredweight, and a hundredweight is 100 pounds, and a gallon of milk is 8 pounds, approximately 8.5 pounds. That's about $10.80, but if you look long-term out to July and August, it's up to $13, $14, and that's a 40% difference. My forecast is that those higher prices in the later months of 2009 are going to come down, and I think we're going to have $11.50 Class 3 milk throughout 2009. And that may not mean anything, but in 2008, we averaged about $17 or $18 hundredweight for Class 3 milk. So it's a significant drop this year.
I'm so happy we had you on. This has been such an education. Thank you.
You're more than welcome. Anytime.
Professor Brian Gould is an agricultural economist at the University of Wisconsin. We've been talking about the glut of milk on the market that's pushing prices down by as much as 40% for farmers. We talk about what to eat on this show and about how to eat. The rules of etiquette are shredded every time someone starts to consume food. Next, how to eat food on mass transit, advice from our etiquette expert. That's when Good Food returns on KCRW and KCRW.com.
If you spent any time at all on a crowded bus next to somebody eating a drippy, smelly burrito, you probably have an opinion about our next topic. Is it acceptable to eat while riding on mass transit? Helena Eichland, author of Chow.com's Etiquette Advice column, is here to share her ideas on the subject. Hi, Helena.
Hi, Evan. How's it going?
Is it acceptable to eat on a crowded bus or subway?
Well, I've been thinking about this recently because I just got back from London. I was there for 3 weeks and I took the tube and the bus a lot. And the entire 3 weeks I was there, I think I saw one person eating on the tube, and he was eating some takeout sushi, and he was sort of hunched over, like as if to hide what he was doing, and sort of taking little glances around to see how people were reacting. And I was just thinking, it's such an American thing to eat on the go like that, to eat on the train or the bus. And I think it can be smelly and messy, but that's not, for me, that's not the real reason why you shouldn't do it. The reason is when I see somebody sitting on the underground, scarfing down a burrito, I feel really sorry for them. Because firstly, they probably have really dirty hands. And secondly, it's just, I feel like you should take 10 minutes for a meal. Because eating, having a meal is like one of the few reliable pleasures in your day. So take 10 minutes for it, rather than just sort of stuffing it down like that.
It's something that we seem to do all the time, though.
Yeah, but I think we should try not to. I mean, sometimes it's unavoidable, you know, like you got up late and you're on your way to work and you have to have a granola bar or something. But I think in general, you should avoid doing it.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I have to say that I almost never eat in the car. Almost never. And I think some of my friends find that weird that I never eat in my car.
Do people in LA eat in their cars a lot? They must do.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Sure, because you spend so much time in your car. And if you have like an hour and a half around lunchtime to get from one appointment to the other, and you know you're going to be in the middle of traffic and you're starving, what else can you do?
Right.
Now, I have a question for you, a little permutation on this theme. Airlines now are not supplying food in the same way that they used to. So what is happening? What is changing now on airplanes in terms of eating? That used to be such sort of a break in the boredom.
Right. And I think you can't just take something that's going to be, you have to take something more than peanuts in a bag or a granola bar, because the thing about eating on airplanes is you don't really do it so much because you're hungry, although that's part of it. You do it because you're bored. And that's why airlines traditionally serve, you know, all these little meals, and then each meal has loads of little things in it that you can unwrap. So I think when you go on a plane and you're taking your meal, it should be something, obviously, that's not smelly, not messy, if possible, but it should be something that comes in lots of little packages that you can unwrap.
I wonder if there's going to be a whole new kind of meal kit that's going to be prepared for people who travel a lot with all these tiny little things in it. Like it used to be that you would see the tiny little salt shaker, the tiny little pepper shaker. And that used to be so much fun, setting it out there on your tray.
Yeah, it gives you something to play with.
And also what comes up when we're traveling is now we're not all eating at the same time on the plane. Because if you bring
right.
your own food, you can sort of eat whenever you want.
Right. And then if you're eating something particularly delicious, if you're into food, you might have made yourself a very nice sandwich or something, then you might feel a bit sort of bad about it. I was on the plane to England. I made a picnic for my husband and myself, and I made a roasted vegetable baguette, and we had some homemade cake and some plums and some almonds. And I felt bad for the person who was sitting next to us who just had like a really sad snack box.
Oh, gosh. Terrible. But it is. I mean, it's like if you're traveling to Europe, you could look at it as a pre-European picnic.
Right. Well, you can always offer something to your seatmate, something small like a cookie.
Now, what about the loudness of the food? Should we avoid crunchy things or should we just go ahead and munch on?
You know, I think there's enough background noise on airplanes for it to be okay to just sort of crunch away.
Okay. So I guess eating in public places, but you know, not in a restaurant way. Very odd. You're right. It is sad.
And just to sort of wrap up the airplane thing, I think the one thing you should not do is get some really smelly takeout from a concession stand. You know, like there's always pizza in the airport. You shouldn't get a big greasy pepperoni pizza and then eat half of it and then sort of stash the rest in a box under your seat. Because you don't want to smell that for like 10 hours on the
10
way to
hours.
Wherever.
That's true. That's true. Maybe not a big juicy corned beef sandwich either. Well, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Find Helena Eichlin's funny and astute etiquette columns at chow.com, an online food magazine that has videos and cooking tips. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood to learn more. In the 1970s, the word, quote, organic, unquote, meant hippie food. Look how far we've come. When Good Food continues, I'll introduce you to an early hippie, I mean organic, chef. That's next on KCRW and KCRW.com. Some cookbooks are tomes you read like a scholar. Some are nearly pornographic that you peruse for inspiration. But the ones you use, actually use and get dirty, are really few and far between. I've known chef and author Jessie Kuhl for ages. She was cooking local and organic while most of us were embracing the far away and the exotic. So it's no surprise that her love letter to seasonality, called Simply Organic, is filled with dishes you actually want to cook. Hi, Jessie.
It's about time, Evan.
I know.
We have been all over the world, and here we are
in your
hometown.
Yeah, that's true. When did you start cooking?
Well, I started cooking as a little girl. In a coal mining town in western Pennsylvania, but I opened my first restaurant using organics in 1976.
Wow. I mean, here in L.A., you couldn't even get flat-leaf parsley.
No, I couldn't put the word organic on the menu.
Why?
They thought it would be hippy-dippy, disgusting, crunchy, granola, terrible-tasting food, even though we were making regular everything, baking biscuits and, you know, doing beautiful vegetables.
So were you a child of hippies? How did you get introduced so early?
Well, I was
organics.
A hippie, Evan. I'm a little older than you, but I came from a town where my dad owned a grocery store and grew organic food, and my uncle actually had the processing plant for meat. And being of such rich ethnic background, the Jewish-Italian, food was in my blood, and it was, without words, organic, local, and sustainable. Those words didn't exist, but we know that's just what the way it was.
So when you first opened Flea Street, which is your little cafe that you have, where is it?
It's in Menlo Park, but my first restaurant was called Late for the Train, and that was the little gem of a tiny 40-seat restaurant that served breakfast and lunch. Very sweet, very understated, where we just felt like we wanted to protect our employees first by not having them prepare any food that might be tainted with something, and then that spilled over into our customers' protection and just, you know, cooking up real food.
So living in California, all the seasons kind of merge. Maybe a little less so.
A little
for you.
Less in North California.
In Northern California.
We are different up there.
Yes, you are different. But how do you let the market guide you when the calendar says that it's fall?
Well, I think, first of all, if you don't have your own garden, then the best way to discover seasonal food is through farmers markets or a CSA box, because they're going to give you community support agriculture. They're going to give you the best of what they have available at that moment. It's interesting because I don't know about you, but when people ask me what's the next trend, and my response is local, season, organic is in the past, though it's very important and we have to stay with it. It is that I think it's the young are going to cook in their kitchens. They're going to kick off the shoes, high-heeled shoes sometimes, open a bottle of wine, and start cooking for one another and sitting at a table and talking again. I mean, those of us that are old hippies did it anyway. We liked to cook, and we knew that, you know, we could show our love and care for ourselves, our family, and our community through cooking and eating. We know that's just the way it is. But I think the young are starting to realize that not only does that exist, but that also has great elements on the environment.
And I think there's a really big difference between weekend cooking and weekday cooking. I think a lot of people who have intentions to cook more tend to do a lot of it on the weekends, although who knows with this economy. I think obviously people are cooking mm-hmm. more every night.
It's pushing you back in the kitchen again.
Yeah, it is. I would like to introduce people to two or three ideas that they can fold into their repertoire and becomes a part of their, you know, weekly 10.
First of all, I think if you take a day a week for an hour or so and just, you know, steam, braise, whatever you have in there, wash it so you're ready for the week. You don't have to do anything complicated. Just either slice it raw or cook it a little bit so it's available to you. And then...
And you'll throw away less if you do that.
You will, because it'll be there to grab. I mean, I snack on things if it's cooked and ready, like, you know, winter squash or even steamed carrots. I will eat it faster if it's ready for me. And then the other hint I would give people is think simple, which is why the book is called Simply Organic. There are 7 ingredients that you can think of that you can make anything taste good, cooked or raw. Fat, either olive oil or butter. Acid, either vinegar or lemon or a little white wine. Salt, pepper, sugar. And you as a cook know that we both agree a little sugar is needed in cooking. Anything you get at the farmer's market that you intuitively know will taste good raw, or intuitively you know, I better cook that artichoke because it's going to not be easy raw. Or, of course, I have to cook the squash. And you use those ingredients, you can make a meal for yourself or someone else. We cook. You do it naturally, intuitively, and we think it's easy. And I actually teach a class with Stanford from the garden. And by the third class, when I ask them, so what's happening for you from going in the garden and picking whatever's there and using those 7 ingredients? And they always look at me and say, we didn't realize it was so simple. And I thought, oh, thank goodness. Because there's this fear or something going on that it's hard, or gourmet means, you know, spending too much time in the kitchen. It doesn't have to. A beautiful baked potato with a little butter, olive oil, and salt and pepper and onion makes me real happy.
Yeah. If I can have a salad with lots of crunchy stuff on the side of that, I'm ready to go.
Or steamed beets with, you know, a drizzle of vinegar and oil and a little sugar let's put some cheese on top of it too.
Oh, yeah, yummy.
Yeah.
What a pleasure, Jesse. It's wonderful to have you here and see you in person.
Finally.
Take care. Jesse Zifkul is a longtime chef and restaurant owner. She has a book out now that we featured in the Good Food Cookbook Club called Simply Organic. I've got a recipe or two at kcrw.com/goodfood for you to try. I'm collecting fans on Facebook. Add me, Evan Kleiman, to your profile. Also, did you know that you can embed the show on your blog or webpage? Go to kcrw.com/goodfood and click listen. You can read the Good Food blog there, too. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. The show is produced by Harriet Ells, Bob Carlson, Holly Tarson, Connie Alvarez, Candace Moyer, and Steve Billings. Gary Macias is our music supervisor. See you next week for another edition of Good Food.